From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
A day of political jousting in Washington and Caracas. We begin with this press conference with Kellyanne Conway at the White House.
This weekend saying he's going to designate it as a organization of terror. Under what authority can he designate domestic terrorist organizations? Because there's no law that enables the president or any agent of the government to do that, as opposed to foreign terrorist organizations, which are designated by the Secretary of State.
So as the president said, he has people looking at that. And as you know, we've discussed here over the last 2 weeks, there's an increase in domestic terror. The director of the FBI, Christopher Wray, made that clear on July 23rd in a sworn testimony to Congress. Most of you didn't cover because it was the day before Mueller's not so impressive testimony. You were telling us what he was going to say instead of listening to Director Wray. But Director Wray has made clear that there is an increase in the number of arrests that the FBI is making with respect to domestic terror. That includes white supremacy. It also includes Antifa, probably includes anti-Semitism, all forms of hate, which does come in many different forms. So the president's looking at, I don't know how anybody can watch the tapes coming out of Portland and think that one's any of our First Amendment rights to free speech somehow extends to physical violence. It simply does not. You cannot just pick and choose who you think is criminally reprehensible and worthy of punishment based on their politics, whether they have a red MAGA hat on or something else.
No, but you also can't just make up domestic terrorism.
Well, the president's not making anything up. He's responding to the increase in domestic terror, which includes white supremacy, which includes Antifa, which includes anti-Semitism. And I'm, for one, very happy that the FBI is focused on both international terror and domestic terror. Anyone else? Well, I think the president made clear yesterday he would like a humanitarian, peaceful resolution there. We're watching the protesters in Hong Kong, throngs of them. This is not a small group. And he made that very clear yesterday, that he hopes that there is a peaceful resolution there as well.
Does the U.S. still support pro-democracy protesters around the world if it's not going to support the protesters in Hong Kong?
Well, the United States, of course, supports democracy around the world. And I just answered the question about Hong Kong and China. The president has tweeted and made remarks, at least very much made remarks, about the protesters in Hong Kong, and is working on many different issues and many different situations with China right now, and that's among them.
Can you talk a little bit about the president's schedule to the G7? Which leaders is he going to meet?
Yeah, that has not been finalized yet. I've seen some of that, but you've seen the president at these G7s, G20s before, the multilateral summits. He'll be meeting with any number of world leaders while he participates in the regular meetings, and that will be finalized this week.
Hillary, any questions about fears about a recession? The president said yesterday that most economists say that there's not going to be a recession. Do you know specifically who he's talking to about that, where he's getting that from?
Yes, I do. Okay. But I'd like to know where you're getting your information from, because it's nice to see the media finally cover the Trump economy. You seem to cover it only when you can use the Sesame Street word of the day, recession. And so you're using a tweet here, or a report there, or an economist's words here and there. The fact is, the fundamentals of our economy are very strong, and you know it. We have more people working in this country right now than ever before in the nation's history. We have more people coming off the sidelines going back to work. We have people who don't just have job availability, but now they have job security. In fact, they have job mobility. They can go and try to compete for one of the other 7 million plus jobs that are available, apart from the one they may already have, or the part-time one they may have, or one that doesn't have sufficient benefits or is too far from home for them, so that they've got all these choices. It's called freedom and free market. Contrast that to Medicare for all and Green New Deals and taxes for everyone else and free health care for illegal immigrants. That would tank our economy, and everybody knows that. So I see now, post Mueller bomb, not bombshell, post hunt for collusion that never happened, conspiracy indictments that will never come to pass, I see now that we're focused on the economy, because you know that is the president's strongest suit, that a majority of Americans approve of the way he's handling the economy in most legitimate polls. So the fundamentals are strong. I would also say that consumer confidence is very high. The optimism is there. 500,000 plus manufacturing jobs since the president got elected, 6 million plus new jobs since the president got elected. The unemployment rates are low. the growth rates are higher, the confidence levels are high, and that matters. Consumers are spending their money, and many of them are saving, and many others don't have to dip into their savings to meet basic household needs. So he didn't need the proverbial magic wand that his presidential predecessor claimed he would need. He just needed the courage that others did not have to cut taxes across the board, including for job creators and businesses and employers, to double the child care tax credit, to have an energy development program in this country that now lets us be a net exporter of natural gas and oil for the first time at these levels, and the deregulation agenda. You know, we hear from many property owners, small business owners, aspiring small business owners, that the deregulatory agenda, which is basically about 12 or 13 old regulations out for every new one in, and that new one in is important too, because regulation, if done properly, is very important to our nation's safety and well-being. The small business owners say the deregulation is just as important as the tax cuts. So the fundamentals remain strong. It's good to hear people covering the economy again after such a lengthy hiatus. But again, you don't have a magic wand to say, and now we're in a recession. Last one.
What kinds of regulations would the president like to see?
Well, the president, fortunately, a year and a half ago, had the courage to do what his predecessor did not, which is to sign into law the Fix NICS. He did that in March of 2018. NICS is, of course, the acronym that stands for National Criminal Instant Check, you know, Background Check System, thereabouts. Essentially, there were many loopholes in that, and he fixed that. And that was bipartisan. It was part of the budget deal. And that would have prevented the murderer, whose name I won't say, in Charleston in June of 2015 at the historically black church. That should have prevented Aurora. That should have prevented Sutherland Springs. In other words, people who should have failed their background checks if their prior felony convictions were in the system and if the systems were talking to each other properly. The president also is looking at what we can do to take a look as a country at these fact patterns that are chilling to so many of us. You look at the Parkland, Florida shooter. He had aspired to be a school shooter and got his wish ultimately. But local authorities had visited his different homes dozens and dozens of times, and nothing happened. He wasn't removed. He apparently didn't get the help he needed, and yet he got firearms and made good on his aspiration to become a school shooter. The fact pattern in Dayton, Ohio, where this person has a kill list and a rape list for boys and girls respectively in high school, but somehow the juvenile records will not transfer over when he goes and legally procures firearms. So when the president says we need to fix the mental health system, look at mental health, he's not saying everybody who is in treatment for mental health is a shooter. He's not saying every shooter has mental health issues. What he's saying is that we have specific incidences where that has been an issue and has been ignored. I am very grateful and overwhelmed, really, with joy and gratitude to all of the first responders who worked arduously to stop those three would-be mass shooters just in this last week, it's been reported. Because people are learning that when you see something, say something after 9/11, doesn't just apply to packages, it applies to people. And the more people can stand up and say, you know what, this kid down the street is scaring everybody, he comes out with firearms, or he's seems a little off at school, or you can make anonymous tips. It can be investigated. And it can be investigated so that people who need help get it, and they don't get firearms when they shouldn't have firearms. All of this could be stopped. There's a great Politico article from about 3 days ago. Really, all of you should read. It's basically entitled, you know, the real reason why President Obama never passed gun control or never took action on it. But it goes down chapter and verse of how he didn't really campaign on it in 2008 or 2012. You had a lot of Democrats in the United States Senate, including some who are still serving on Capitol Hill when they're here, who voted against the assault weapons ban in 2013. There was not a lot of excitement and robust effort on the part of the Democrats when they had a veto-proof Senate majority to pass gun control. So this president is at least trying to fix the problems that we see as deficits within the system. He gave a speech 2 weeks ago this morning that said he would look at red flags. If they were right, he would look at, I think it's Toomey Coons, that is a fixed NICS violation bill. So we're looking at many different avenues, but there will be no confiscation of of firearms from Americans who possess them legally under the Second Amendment and through the Heller decision by the United States Supreme Court, which President Obama also made joyful noises about, but read the article. We will not confiscate legally owned firearms without due process. That's not going to happen, and that's where some of this is going with some of the folks on Capitol Hill.
There was also political sparring in Caracas, Venezuela, where President Nicolas Maduro challenged his U.S.-backed rival to test his claimed popularity with early elections. We have this report from Press TV's Jesus Silva.
President of Venezuela Nicolas Maduro proposed the celebration of anticipated elections this year to renew the members of the country's Congress, also known as the National Assembly. The proposal comes as a response to the opposition-led parliament, who has consistently but unsuccessfully tried ways to remove Maduro from presidency ever since the opposition won the last parliamentary vote in 2015. However, while parliamentary efforts to destitute Maduro have been ruled out by the Supreme Court of Justice, the possibility of early elections for Congress seems to receive green light by the top-ranked judges. Officials say these elections must be called on as they are based on the Constitution. Gracias.
Legislative elections can be held this year if the Constituent Assembly rules to do so. That is allowed by the Magna Carta and nobody can prevent it.
Nonetheless, the opposition decries the election.
Opposition congressmen were elected for a five-year term, but the government wants to get rid of them before the end of the term via a rigged election.
But people on the streets support the idea of early elections.
The opposition ruled Congress backs the illegal U.S. blockade on Venezuela, so they are guilty for the country's hardship. Venezuelans want to elect a new Congress.
If elections were held this year, Maduro's party would win because opposition parties are divided and have no credible leader to follow.
Experts believe the early election would let Maduro take control over the legislative branch, so it would no longer work as an opposition platform to destabilize his government.
This past May, a group of activists were arrested in Washington, D.C., and forcibly removed from the Venezuelan embassy after spending more than a month there defending it against the U.S. government. Margaret Flowers, Adrian Pine, David Paul, and Kevin Zeiss were the last of about 50 demonstrators who had spent time living inside the embassy since mid-April. Federal law enforcement officials arrested the four after prying open the embassy door at the request of the U.S.-sanctioned opposition leader Juan Guaido. That case is now winding itself through the federal courts. For more on that, we spoke with Kevin Zeiss, who is an attorney and activist based in the Washington, D.C. area, via Skype on Monday. Well, Kevin, it's a pleasure to have you with us, first of all.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks. What triggered this, I guess, you know, we discussed the defense of the Venezuelan embassy that you guys had done earlier this year, and your arrest and, you know, being dragged out or whatever, escorted out of the place. There is this ongoing legal battle in the background, which is taking place in a sort of more of a geological time frame than the events were then. But I saw an article reporting on some of this stuff in one of the workers.org website, and I wanted to get an update from you. And first of all, just remind people, you know, some of the background stuff. I mean, we discussed this here frequently, what's been happening in Venezuela, but what was happening, you know, particularly at that time, what played out in Washington, D.C. at the embassy, sure. And then what you guys have going forward.
Sure. Well, let me start with, you mentioned we were escorted out. Well, escorted out in handcuffs.
right.
there were more than 100 police who invaded the Venezuelan embassy from five different police agencies. And the agency in charge of protecting embassies is the Secret Service. So we had a lot of federal police. Mm-hmm. They came with flak jacks and military gear, even though we had said so in writing that we would not resist arrest. We would not voluntarily leave, but we would not resist arrest. We wouldn't hide. We wouldn't blockade the doors or anything along those lines. They still came with military force and arrested us. They could have brought us to that was at breakfast, basically. They could have taken us to the magistrate that day, but instead they kept us in jail overnight, giving us some punishment before trial.
Yeah.
The magistrates don't meet in D.C. until 1:30, so they had plenty of time to bring us to the magistrate, but chose not to. Mm. And all this stemmed out of an effort by a large group of people to protect the Venezuelan embassy and uphold international law. International law under the Vienna Convention requires the U.S. to defend embassies in their country and not intrude in them. Their embassies are inviolate. They cannot be violated. And so we went in and were given permission by the Venezuelan government, the elected Venezuelan government of President Maduro. We were given permission to stay in the embassy as interim embassy protectors. And interim because there was negotiation going on between the U.S. and Venezuela to protect the Venezuelan embassy in Caracas. The Venezuelan embassy in Georgetown and the U.S. embassy in Caracas. Both were vacant because they had broken diplomatic relations. And Switzerland was going to be the third party protector in Caracas, and Turkey was going to be a third party protector in Washington D.C. So we were the interim protectors as that negotiation went forward. At a certain point, the Trump administration decided to enter and arrest us. And so now we're facing federal criminal charges. We have our next hearing on October 4th. It'll be a status conference to discuss the status of the case. We've had a couple of hearings already. We expect there'll be a lot of different battles before a trial, battles over discovery, documents that the government should give us as part of our defense, and we'll have to probably have the court rule on those issues. There'll probably be a motion to dismiss at some point. That's a routine matter in criminal cases. And then I expect we'll probably get to trial maybe next spring. We're very happy that there has been a coalition created, the Embassy Protectors Defense Committee, that is using our case to organize around Venezuela and also raising money for our defense. It's defendembassyprotectors.org, defendembassyprotectors.org. If you want to get involved in helping to use this case to mobilize around Venezuela, as well as to help us defend ourselves. We're facing a year in jail, $100,000 fine each.
Whoa.
And the government so far, their plea bargain offer has been plead guilty and let the judge sentence you.
Whoa.
So it's not much of an offer.
Right.
So I think that Bolton and Pompeo and Trump and Elliot Abrams not very happy with us for defending the embassy, trying to uphold international law. So they want to put us in jail. And so we're taking that case very seriously and working to build up a strong defense.
In terms of seriously, this from the sentencing you just, the sentence that this carries that you just described, we're talking felonies, not misdemeanors here. So is that correct? I haven't looked at statute.
No, it's a misdemeanor.
But it is.
They're not treating it like they treat most misdemeanors. You would not, at the first hearing, the prosecutor said, we're plead guilty and get time served because we spent the night in jail. That's probably more than you get for most misdemeanors. But in this case, the government really wants to put us in jail. They want to do the best they can to hold us accountable in a very heavy way so no one else would ever dare to stand up to U.S. empire again in the United States.
Well, I heard you say up to a year, so which was normally is more of a mark of a misdemeanor. But I also heard you said, what, $100,000?
$100,000 fine. And
that's not usually a misdemeanor, okay?
That's true. That's true. And in their plea offer, they said they'd also try to charge us with the cost of the police and any damage done to the embassy. Of course, we didn't do any damage to the embassy, but they want to stick us to us financially if they can. So it's a serious effort that we're undertaking here. We have a strong legal team. We're working hard to defend ourselves. It's us against the United States, and it's a pretty vicious United States that's pretty angry about this coup that they've been trying to do in Venezuela, failing and failing and failing, but they're still trying to pursue it. And it's very bizarre. You see his recent reports this week, secret negotiations between Venezuela and the United States to remove Maduro from power.
Right.
Well, that's a critical thing.
Right.
Maduro, they're admitting Maduro's in power. So if they're, right. Maduro's in power, who authorized them to come into the embassy?
Right.
They violated international law to come into the embassy. So it's such an absurd situation. But, you know, that's the fight we're in. And we hope people go to embassyprotectors.org, get involved, and help us to stand up to this this rogue regime that's trying to take over Venezuela with a coup d'etat.
I mean, you mentioned Vienna, okay? The Vienna law convention. That governs. Yeah. And so their end run around Vienna is essentially, well, we're going to pick the government that picks the embassy staff. That's right. The logic of their position, right?
Exactly. And then what's even more bizarre about that, to add to that logic, we're going to pick the government, we're going to try to do a coup, and if the coup fails, we're going to take the embassy anyway.
Right. That's right, which is what's happened thus far, right?
Now, if a coup succeeds and there's a new government that comes in, well, then that government is in charge of the embassy.
After the fact.
A coup fails, you don't get to take the property.
Yeah, you know, I guess that actually is going to impact on how your case plays out, too.
I think it's going to be central.
Yeah, right. If they succeed in placing, alternative dude in the presidential seat there, then after the fact, you did in fact illegally occupy blah 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 blah. That'll be their argument.
Well, they're making the argument that Trump recognizes Guaido as president now, and so
right.
he has the power to
right.
decide.
Right.
Even though the Venezuelan government actually owns the building, it wasn't leasing the embassy; it owns
right.
it. And UN recognizes President Maduro, and Venezuelan law recognizes President Maduro, and Guaido violated Venezuelan law in appointing himself president. So the law is on our side. It's this fiction that Trump is, you know, Mickey Mouse is president, and so Mickey Mouse gets to decide what to do with the embassy. That's pretty much what we're dealing with.
Gotcha. So going forward, first of all, what's been happening? You mentioned this past week that you have so-called secret talks going on, negotiations, and you've had Russia sent some naval folks passing through Venezuela. China's going to help modernize or invest in some of the oil facilities and such. How are things playing out?
It's very, it's a really interesting situation, and it's a very dangerous situation. When we were in the embassy, and the first time that the police came to the door, they cut the locks in the front door. We were in the vestibule, and they were trying to decide whether to come in and arrest us. We would not leave voluntarily, and they decided not to come in. We made it clear to them that if they crossed that threshold and violated international law, violated the Vienna Convention, it would escalate tensions between the U.S. and Venezuela when we should be de-escalating tensions.
Right.
And it's a serious risk because Russia and China have allied with Venezuela. And so if there is a military conflict, it could become a global
right.
conflict.
Right.
Trump is talking about sending Navy ships to surround Venezuela's coastline. Russia right. and Venezuela just agreed that Russian Navy ships can go and dock in Venezuela. So right now, if that proceeds, you have U.S. and Russian Navy vessels facing off.
Right.
That is scary.
I mean, we were looking at World War III over Cuba, okay? Venezuela as an asset to, say, the oil companies that make policy for the U.S., much more valuable than say, sugarcane.
Exactly, and it's not just oil, where Venezuela has the number one
gold.
Oil reserve.
Yeah.
Venezuela is number one in gold,
yep.
number one in diamonds,
yep.
number five in gas.
Yep.
It has all the very large quantities of minerals needed for electronics and weapons,
yep.
And they have a lot of fresh water. So
yep.
Venezuela has a lot of natural resources. It's a very important country for geopolitical dominance. If the U.S. could get those resources, that would be very important for not only U.S. business, but for the U.S. military. So that's what this is about.
Yeah, there's another dimension to this, too. You know, we've seen the rise of multipolarity globally, okay, and we saw
right.
like the last tide rise up, peaking at, say, the BRICS, when you had the BRICS group as an independent group maybe
sure.
two years ago. Well, Brazil partially rested on Venezuela's you know, Brazil's independence partially rested on Venezuela's role in helping to organize, you know, this entire project in Latin America for, you know, sovereignty, self-defense,
right,
you know, and all of that. And this is one of the reasons that Venezuela has been a primary target. I mean, Cuba, its revolution has been an example and inspiration for people and a lot of assistance around the region. But Venezuela was putting its shoulder to the back of the car and pushing with a lot of money and assistance to people all over the region. And they take them out. There's global implications for that outside of whether there's a war.
That's exactly right. I mean, when Venezuela was, when Hugo Chavez was in power and the oil prices are over $150 a barrel and Venezuela had a lot of money, Venezuela was funding Caribbean countries, Haiti. It was funding a whole Latin American system. The Telesur TV network came out a lot about Venezuela funding. And so Venezuela was a major player in lifting the what was called the pink tide. And as Venezuela, as the price of oil got cut, which many think was actually an intentional tactic by the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, but it's now $50 a barrel instead of
right.
$150, Venezuela doesn't have the resources it used to have. And then on top of that, the U.S. economic war, the sanctions, which have now become a blockade, that makes it even worse. And so, yeah, a lot of countries depended on Venezuela's leadership. And I think Venezuela withstanding this coup is a very powerful message. That
agreed.
The U.S. is throwing everything at it.
Yep.
Everything is at the military. And they can't do the military because it's very risky with Russia and China on the side. It's very risky because Venezuela has a very large civilian defense force of over 2 million people. It has a military of 200,000. The U.S. could not go into Venezuela easily, even without Russia and China. But with Russia and China, it becomes very risky for the U.S. to do it. So Venezuela is withstanding all the pressure. It's pretty impressive. They deserve our support. And that's what when we went to the Venezuelan embassy, we knew the U.S. was seizing other Venezuelan properties in the United States. And so we asked if we could stay to protect international law. And they thought about it and decided that they'd let us do it. And so we stayed with their permission. They gave us the key. We were there without violating any trespass laws or unlawful entry. We were there legitimately and legally. And that's why they had to make it this weird charge of interfering with protective functions. That's what we're charged with.
Right.
Interfering with protective functions is the charge, because they couldn't charge us with trespass or breaking and entering. So it's a very strange situation.
Strange.
But we're going to fight as best we can. We just need everybody's help.
Mm. I'm thinking about as this thing has developed in Latin America since 98, really, that the terrain in Venezuela, Argentina, Brazil in particular, you've seen like a pretty, like somewhere between a 60-40 and 50-50 split in the population on the question of, you know, left or, you know, the old ways and here with practically U.S. occupation of the countries. And that in Brazil, for example, if they had let Lula run, he would have won the election after all the things that have happened there with the corporate media, you know, beating up on him and Dilma Rousseff, yet still you'd have a majority of the electorate doing it. Macri just got spanked and he's on his way out, obviously. And I'm wondering if the U.S. dared to actually do a military intervention in Venezuela, that they might be risking something here that they haven't even risked in the Middle East, and that is lighting a fire in their own backyard that they can't put out.
I agree. That'd be a very risky move to do that. You add to Lula in Brazil, you have AMLO in Mexico, you have the unrest in Central America, the protests against the coup governments there. You can see another pink tide coming very quickly.
Yeah.
And I don't, an attack on Venezuela would just escalate it.
Yeah.
If Colombia was foolish enough to get involved in a military attack on Venezuela with the Yankee imperialists, their right wing would be decimated. And you see Colombia move to the left, because that was a much closer election than people expected.
That's right.
And then Brazil's on the other border. And if Brazil were to join in, Bolsonaro's not in a very strong position as it is. And so you could have an attack on Venezuela would be an escalation, and I see a move to the left in many countries throughout the region.
Kevin, thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Happy to do it. Thanks for having me on. Talk to you soon.
Yep.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.